The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
If I hadn't made a left-hand turn, if you hadn't made a right, if I'd waited just a moment more, if you'd missed the light, if that car had never blown its
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Duncan Watts. Duncan is a principal researcher from Microsoft and an A.D. White professor at large at Cornell University. From 2000 to 2007, he was a professor of sociology at Columbia University and then a principal research scientist at Yahoo, where he directed the Human Social Dynamics Group. He has won a number of awards and written three books, including Everything is Obvious, Once You Know the Answer. Duncan Watts, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kelly. Great to be here.
So I want to dig deep into your book, Everything is Obvious, but I think a good starting point for our conversation can relate to a piece you wrote on Medium in January of this year titled The Non-Inevitability of Donald Trump and Almost Everything. In this piece, you talk about the various hand-wringing post-election analysis that tries to figure out what we all got wrong. But at the end, you write, quote, as consequential as this election may one day seem, there was nothing inevitable about it, nor is there anything inevitable about the future. Tell us what you mean.
Well, you know, we have this it's interesting. If we think about things that are about to happen, and in fact, if we cast our mind back to before the election, people were very confident that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. And in fact, it seems like even Donald Trump was pretty confident that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election.
Yep.
And so, when something unexpected like that happens, the first reaction is shock, but the second reaction is rationalization, where we sort of go back over everything that we were paying attention to and we're not paying attention to. We go back over all the predictions and we find little pieces of information that certain people saying, if you only look in this part of the country, you find everybody here wants to vote for Donald Trump. And we convince ourselves that, in fact, the thing that was not expected was really inevitable after all. Hmm. And we were just sort of looking in the wrong places. We were paying attention to the wrong information. And what's interesting to me about this kind of, after-the-fact rationalization of even the most surprising outcomes is that it speaks to a deeper, fundamental belief system that we have about the universe, right? That we think that the universe is kind of deterministic, that things have been planned out, that there is a path that has been set, that the future is in some sense already determined for us, and that we just don't know about it, right? There is sort of a veil of ignorance between us and the future, but that that's just because we're not smart enough, or because we're not looking at the right information, and that at some point that veil will be ripped away, and we'll see what was laid out in front of us. And that belief is so strong that we would rather hold on to it than accept that something we really don't like was just an accident.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is and this really speaks to the core of your book, Everything is Obvious, because I think for many people, the one thing that they hold dear or find like ultimately reliable is this idea of common sense, right? We talk about this like, oh, well, this is just common sense. And you write that common sense, quote, is not so much a worldview as a grab bag of logically inconsistent, often contradictory beliefs, each of which seems right at the time but carries no guarantee of being right at any other time. So you really don't believe in common sense, I think.
Well, actually, I do believe common sense.
Okay.
I just believe that common sense serves a somewhat different purpose than we attribute to it.
All right.
So common sense is great for everyday activities, right? So if we're, you know, trying to decide what to wear to work or how to, you know, speak to our in-laws when they're visiting for Thanksgiving, how to conduct ourselves while walking down the street, and, you know, avoiding all the crowds of people while still trying to get where we want to go. You know, we're following these very kind of intricate, context-dependent rules that would be extremely difficult to program into a computer. And in fact, one of the, you know, the remaining grand challenges of artificial intelligence is common sense, right? This is something that for all the progress that we have made in teaching computers to play chess or drive vehicles by themselves, very, very little progress has been made in teaching computers anything that might pass as common sense. And the reason is that it's so complicated and it's so context dependent that in some sense you have to sort of teach a computer everything about the world in order to, you know, get them to walk down the street without embarrassing themselves, right?
Hmm, yep.
So common sense is really remarkable. And, you know, I have tremendous respect for it. And certainly I try to exhibit common sense in my everyday behavior.
Yeah.
The argument that I make in the book is that common sense is so good at getting us through everyday situations that we have this kind of universal reverence for it, right? And we tend to use it for making decisions about situations that are not everyday situations, right? Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to make a decision about, you know, to use your common sense to decide, you know, what to wear to work or how to talk to somebody, but it's another to use your common sense to, you know, fix healthcare or decide what the correct trade policy should be for an entire country or to revamp the tax code, right? These are decisions that, you know, have repercussions for millions of people who are very different, who are not standing there in front of you, and who are spread out over vast sectors of the country and the economy and are interacting with each other in very, very complicated ways. And those kinds of decisions, you know, I mean, it's not clear that any kind of knowledge is really up to making those kinds of decisions in a sort of reliable way. But they require, you know, really deep understanding of very technical, complex subjects. And yet, we tend to think, oh, well, if we just used our common sense, if politicians would just use their common sense, all of these problems would just go away. So it's really what I'm saying in the book is that we are misusing common sense. We are taking it from a domain in which it works very well, the everyday, and we're using it to make decisions about these vast, complex social systems that have, you know, huge implications for our lives.
So I guess in addition to sort of the sort of misuse of common sense in complex systems, that would also apply maybe to our understanding of history.
That's right. So common sense, one of the sort of amazing things about common sense is that it covers its own tracks. It's a very sort of sneaky form of intelligence because even though it is in some ways completely inconsistent, right? So just think about all the things that your common sense tells you. You know, it tells you that opposite attracts, but birds of a feather flock together, right? Mm-hmm. It tells you these, you know, these are two aphorisms that we know very well, but they actually say opposite things, right? And common sense is filled with these kinds of statements, statements that are logically inconsistent with each other, but that, you know, we can invoke whenever they seem right. And so that's what I mean by common sense is just this sort of grab bag of inconsistent and incoherent information. And we don't see the inconsistency because we're always kind of looking back in time, right? And we're, after something has happened, we know what the outcome was and we know what it seemed like the right thing to have done was. And so we can tell ourselves this story that, you know, if only we'd used our common sense, if only we had picked the thing that now seems like the appropriate thing to have picked, everything would have worked out all right. But of course, you know, that wouldn't have been obvious beforehand, and often it wasn't obvious beforehand, right? So we're sort of we're using information to inform our common sense that we only have after the situation itself has played out, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're judging our performance in the past by what we only know in the future, right? So we call this sometimes in sports, this is called Monday morning quarterbacking. But we're actually doing this on a grand scale all the time, including when we look back at history. Right? So if we go back to the Trump, the 2016 election, the argument that I'm making is there really was uncertainty. It really was unclear who was going to win. And if you look at the polls and you look at the prediction markets, they actually did express, albeit a preference or a preponderance of probability that Clinton would win. They all said that there's some probability that Trump was going to win. And so if you imagine, rolling a 10-sided die, and the probability of rolling a 1 is, one chance in 10. That's a pretty unlikely outcome. You're probably better off betting on the 90% chance of rolling something other than a 1. But one time in 10, you're going to roll a 1. Mm-hmm. And nobody thinks that's crazy. Nobody thinks that's mysterious. It's just that's how chance events work. And there's nothing about the election that is necessarily different from that, right? But our intuition is to say, no, it must have been that way all along, and we just did not. We weren't paying attention to the right things. And now that, we can use our common sense in this sort of time-shifting fashion, because we know the outcome now, we can always go back to before the election and find things that seem like they were relevant, that seem like if we had known about them, if we'd been paying attention to them, we would have predicted the outcome correctly. And so this is the trick that common sense plays on us all the time, that we're always using information that we get after the fact to tell us what we should have been paying attention to beforehand. But we forget that we couldn't have made those predictions if we had to make them at the time.
Yeah, and one thing too is obviously, I mean, it's the story, right? Our brains crave these stories, and when they don't fit the storyline or the narrative that we thought was happening, we lose our minds. And you have actually a lot to say about Malcolm Gladwell, who has been a big proponent of this sort of law of the few, which you talk about in the book. And I've always been a big fan of his. And I was listening to the Revisionist History podcast. And when it came to the podcast on comedy, I actually realized he had significant facts wrong, because this is an area I'm actually an expert in. Yeah. And you call him the poster child for post hoc fallacy. I mean, he's a fantastic storyteller, but that's part of the problem, right?
That is part of the problem. And you know, I don't want to be too hard on Malcolm Gladwell. I pick on him because, first of all, he is such a good storyteller. Mm. And secondly, because he writes about things that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
But really, the problem is storytelling itself, right? That the narrative way of looking at history is, well, what is a narrative? You know, when somebody tells a story, they know what the ending is, right? I mean, when you're reading a mystery novel, you as the reader don't know all the things that are happening. You don't know the significance of all the things that are happening. And so, you're surprised by the ending if it's a good novel. But of course, the author knows how it's going to end, right? And they're carefully constructing all the little things that you're getting mystified and tricked up by, precisely in order to have that effect. So, the whole point of a narrative, the whole thing that makes it a narrative, is that there is an ending at which point everything will make sense, right? So there's something very reassuring about that, and that it's a format of explanation that we're so familiar with. Maybe it's like the original, probably it's the original form of explanation, but there's something very different about telling a story, the elements of which all depend on knowing the ending, and telling us, explaining a scientific theory, right? So we're sort of pretending, people like Gladwell are pretending that they're identifying the cause of things, but really what they're doing is telling a story, and the story depends on knowing the ending, whereas causal explanations are not supposed to depend on that. They're just supposed to identify the mechanisms that are driving the world. And so these are just very, very different, fundamentally different ways of or types of explanation. And by conflating them together, common sense deeply misleads us into thinking that we understand how things work when, in fact, we're really just telling stories.
Yeah. So here's a story, and it's in your book. I worked at a video store in the 1980s, and Betamax was the superior product, the beta tape. But VHS recorders pushed them out of the marketplace. So the story of that time was Sony just blew it. They didn't know what they were doing. But that's not necessarily the case.
That's right. Sony, was really very smart about it. They had actually designed Betamax to do something other than play movies. In fact, before the video war formats, the war in formats played out, people thought that the VCR was going to be used like we use a digital video recorder now,
to
time shift TV,
right?
That wasn't meant to be for watching full-length movies. It was meant to record TV so you could watch it later on.
Mm-hmm.
And because we do this all the time now, this actually wasn't an accurate prediction. This was exactly, this was a pretty good prediction about how video recorders are going to be used. And so Sony didn't worry about the length, having a two-hour length for their cassettes. They just focused on superior quality. Meanwhile, VHS came out with a different strategy, where they were focused on full-length movies, and they were prepared to make a quality sacrifice to get there. So, they just had, both versions were reasonable, and it just so happened that the way the market decided was in favor of full-length movies. So this wasn't a screw-up. This was just, something that happened, and nobody knew in advance how that was going to play out. The consumers themselves didn't know that they were going to make that decision. And, of course, Sony actually also adapted pretty quickly and got themselves, got Betamax up to the appropriate length very rapidly in response. But by then it was too late. So, we have these kind of narratives about who made a mistake and who screwed up and who was smarter. But, really it could have just been and probably was just luck. And afterwards, of course, we don't want to admit that. And so we tell this kind of revisionist story that makes it seem like the best strategy won.
I do want to cover, I want to talk to you about groups, because you have some really interesting writing on that. And Second City, we work in ensembles and we co-create with our audience.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk a lot on this podcast about the power of groups. I love this story when you talk about, what can the popularity of a painting like the Mona Lisa tell us about why that painting has become so popular for so many years. This is a really sort of counterintuitive, surprising story, because I think for most of us, it's like the Mona Lisa is a great work of art. Don't we all just know that?
Right, and I don't think that the Mona Lisa is not a great work of art.
Right.
But it was not considered to be one of the greatest works of art for many, many years. So prior to the beginning of the 19th century, the Mona Lisa was really just sort of a run-of-the-mill masterpiece. There were probably hundreds of paintings that were considered to be more important works of art than the Mona Lisa. And Leonardo was considered to be a little bit of a hack. He was a famous artist and inventor and intellectual, but he wasn't considered to be, in the same league as people like, Rembrandt or Titian, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the real story began with a totally random event after the revolution and the Louvre had been taken over and turned into a museum. The Mona Lisa was in there along with thousands of other paintings, and this young Italian who was working there, Vincent Perugia, decided that it was a criminal act that this Italian artist was being held hostage in France, and so he just stole the Mona Lisa. He stuck it under his jacket and he walked out of the Louvre and took it back to Italy. And this provoked sort of a firestorm of attention and excitement. And, you know, years later, it recovered and was brought back to France. And, you know, it really just turned into a big kind of PR spectacle that had absolutely nothing to do with the quality of the painting itself. And, you know, the history of the Mona Lisa after that point has just sort of been more of the same, where everybody pays attention to it, and because everybody pays attention to it, people pay more attention to it. And so this process that we call cumulative advantage has driven the Mona Lisa from a relatively obscure painting to become far and away the most famous painting in the world. And once again, when we look back, we just can't see that. When we look back, we think nothing could be this famous unless it's the most awesome, right? It just has to be, right? It doesn't compute that some sort of random process building on itself over and over and over again could take something that ex ante wasn't that special. And so we just ignore the history and we say, it's got to be there. And those people were just idiots. They just missed it. They didn't understand how great it really was. And so this is sort of the, you know, the, you know, all of these examples are really making the same point that, you know, we ignore the mechanics of how things actually work because we have this sort of narrative that that's locked in our heads that the outcomes we experience have to be reflected by these intrinsic properties, that the best things should win. And, you know, we can take that back to Donald Trump as well and say, you know, even if you don't like him, you probably think he's some kind of genius, because how else could he have masterminded his election from such poor prospects? So we really are resistant to the idea that these outcomes could just be random.
Yeah, and you also talk about group behaviors, right? And what I found fascinating too is because you deconstruct what happens in groups, and sometimes it's numbers, right? Sometimes it's sequential. It's a one, a two, a three. It's different when it's four, and then 4 million. And we don't tend to think that way. We just think popular, unpopular.
Right. So we, I think, you know, what we have trouble with is understanding how groups are different from individuals. So when we, you know, when we talk about groups, we always talk about them as if they're just kind of big individuals, right? We talk about, you know, firms as if the firm is doing something. We talk about political parties as if the party has, it has a platform, it has a position, it makes a mistake, it has a victory. These are things, these are words that apply to individual people, but we talk about aggregates of people as if they have these individual properties. And markets is a great example. We're always talking about, you know, the market had a good day, the market had a bad day, the market was nervous about this. It's all baloney. The market doesn't think anything at all. The only things who think are individual people, and they're somehow interacting with each other in these very complicated ways to produce this collective behavior. And so this phenomenon of cumulative advantage is something that only exists when you have lots of people all making decisions based upon what the other people's decisions are. But we can't understand that, right? We only think in terms of individuals, and so we just ignore that sort of complex dynamical process, and we just say, well, if the market decided that the Mona Lisa is a great work of art, if the people decided that Donald Trump should be president, then there must be like something like an individual actor who has made that decision, right?
Yep.
And that's very different from what has actually happened.
Yeah, that well, all the talk about fake news and the media is the same thing, where I'm like, you know, what is the, what, if you're saying that the media has a cognitive bias, I mean, all individuals have biases, but I doubt that they're all the same.
That's right. So individuals have biases. But you're right. We talk about the media as if it's a thing, as if this sort of monolithic entity that, you know, can sort of conspire against society or whatever. But once again, you've just got all these individual people who are sort of scrambling to make decisions that are conditioned on what other people are doing. So so it's very this sort of complex emergent system that we're trying. trying to understand, but the mental tools that we have, the toolkit that we have, you know, is arguably a toolkit that, you know, evolved tens of thousands of years ago when we were, you know, in small, you know, hunter-gatherer groups on the savannah, and none of this stuff existed. So we're really trying to understand a much more complex system using intuition that is very good at dealing with individual people, right? We're very good at reading subtle changes in facial expressions, at modulating the tone of voice in just such a way to produce a particular desired effect. I mean, again, these are amazing abilities, but they're all optimized for dealing with a single person at a time. And so our intuition is all about single people. So when we try to apply it to all this stuff about markets and electorates and political parties and the media, we're really papering over all of the complexity with this fiction that we're talking about a single thing.
Yep. Duncan, I know I got to let you go. I wanted to ask you one last question because I've loved this book and I've been talking to a lot of people around the office about it. And I come in and I'm like, you can't predict things. And we're telling stories that it is a fiction and it's not true. Which everyone, like, they first go, that's interesting and terrible. I'm wondering, I mean, as far as the optimist, pessimist side of you, where do you land after you sort of live in this sort of research and write this book?
Well, you know, I get the same reaction from people all the time, which is, you know, the first reaction is to say, no, that can't be right. And then you go through all the arguments and counter-arguments and counter-counter-arguments. And if you eventually sort of wear them down, they say, oh, that's depressing. You know?
Yeah.
Because it means there's no meaning in the world. If everything is random, if it's unpredictable, if all the stories that we tell are really just fooling ourselves, where does the meaning go? And I see what they're saying, but I think it's a mistake. I think that it goes back to this point that we discussed early on about determinism, about thinking that the world is, that the future is already set, and that we're just seeing it uncovered. And this is an assumption that shows up in a lot of religions, particularly Western religions, where we talk about, you know, God's plan. And we, you know, even outside of religion, we talk about fate and we talk about destiny. We have a lot of conceptions that are tied up with our understanding of meaning that are fundamentally deterministic. And so when you sort of rip that away and say, no, it's all random, people think the meaning goes away as well. But I disagree. I think that, you know, that determinism is a statement about how the world works. And meaning is something that we create ourselves. Right? This is a very important point because it is, to me at least, entirely possible to accept that something was totally random, that it wasn't intended by anyone. It wasn't
set up
by any sort of cosmic forces. It just happened, and it didn't have to happen, but it did. And still find meaning in that, because the meaning is something that you create, right? It's perfectly possible to recognize that you met your spouse through some random chance encounter. If you hadn't sort of turned the corner in the right way or sat down on the plane, you would never have met that person. And it's possible to believe that and still believe that everything that happened afterwards is deeply meaningful because that was something that you did. It wasn't something that the universe did. And I think that is a difficult distinction for people to grasp, but I think that's the truth. And that's where I fall down because is that, you know, I continue to be optimistic about meaning. And I'm perfectly happy to accept that a lot of it is just random.
Duncan Watts, thank you for coming on the show.